it's a model that we've, you know, many have worked in for a long time, and it was based on how we were trained. And now as we think about this trauma-informed care model, and a model that I've been embracing now for many years, it moves away from the deficit.
Hello, everyone. I am Isis Garcia Rodriguez, and this is TikTok. Trauma-informed care creates a roadmap to resilience by moving away from a deficit model in which we ask you what's wrong with you to a strengths-based perspective where we ask what happened to you. In an attempt to reach all audiences, the BWH TIC initiative is using the TikTok podcast platform to continue education and disseminate information on trauma-informed care for healthcare providers, patients, educators, and community members. Each week on TikTok, we will be discussing different topics in the healthcare field and looking at them through a trauma-informed lens. For a comprehensive list of the 6 TIC guiding principles and 3 implementation domains, according to SAMHSA, please see the 2 graphics that can be found on Twitter at ALO Boston or listen to episode 1 of this podcast. During this episode, we would like to take the time to explain what trauma-informed care inquiry looks like. With me today is someone who we have had on the show before, Annie Lewis O'Connor. She's the founder and director of the Care Clinic and co-chair of the Partners TIC Initiative. She works at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and is an expert in care of patients that are impacted by trauma, violence, and abuse. Annie, thank you for taking the time to speak with me again.
Thank you for having me back.
Sure. How are you doing today?
Things are wonderful, and I'm real excited to see this podcast series move along. Thank you.
Yeah. So we'll jump right into the topic. So when we think about, you know, inquiry, we're really thinking about, you know, how essentially doctors ask questions to their patients, right?
Sure. Doctors, nurses, social workers.
Awesome. Okay. So currently, what is that encounter? What does that inquiry or screening look like for patients during a healthcare visit?
Yeah, so, you know, often there's scripted-like questions, or some people will refer to them as checklist questions in the electronic health record. You know, for example, there might be a question that would say, are you being hit, kicked, or punched? Are you being forced to perform sexual acts against your will? Do you feel safe at home? Is anyone hurting you? And since the Joint Commission and the U.S. Preventative Task Force promote screening, particularly for domestic violence, such screening questions are often just focused on that alone. And sometimes these questions are asked via a tablet or a questionnaire, and that can be provided to the patient ahead of their visit to their provider, and then that information gets funneled to the provider that's seeing them.
Okay, yeah. So I can definitely see how in the context of, you know, meeting with a patient maybe who has had these experiences that are more traumatic in nature, how that might, you know, create a barrier between this rapport that can be built. So if you're thinking about, you know, trauma, not just, you know, violence and abuse, but just trauma in general, when we're thinking about the way that we define it, how can screening and inquiry really take shape within this context of, you know, trauma?
Yes, a great question, and I want to give a shout-out to my colleagues, Samara Grossman, Dr. Nomi Levy-Carrick, and Dr. Eve Rittenberg. Together, we have really created a visual of this where we think about individual trauma, interpersonal, and collective trauma. And we often feel that in the healthcare field, there's a lot of acknowledgement to the individual traumas. So you ask, what is trauma? Well, we see that trauma really results from an event, a series of events, or a set of circumstances that's experienced by an individual as either physically or emotionally harmful or threatening, and that has lasting effects on the individual's functioning and their physical, social, and emotional well-being. That's actually, SAMHSA has described that as trauma. And we concur with that, and we think it's a little bit, to get a little bit more finite on that, we think about individual trauma that results from an event or maybe some circumstances that occurred in the person's life that really has impacted their functioning, either physically, emotionally, socially, or in some way their behavioral health. when we think of collective trauma, and we also think this is where in healthcare we need to be explicit in talking about this, we're really referring to the cultural, historical, and the sociopolitical trauma that impacts individuals and communities across generations. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, would include racial inequality that is structural in its origin. And it often can avoid, you know, afford privilege to some while it really disadvantages others. And so we do call out historical and structural racism. We call out the power and control dynamics that can often incur in institutions, ageism, homophobia, xenophobia, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But really specifically thinking about some of those traumas that have been rooted into our culture.
Yeah. So when thinking about the way that trauma can really manifest within multiple different avenues in many different forms, like you were saying, individual, interpersonal, collective, when we are sitting with a patient, what are the ways in which we can really use a trauma-informed lens to be able to listen to those folks and be able to understand what they're disclosing to us during some sort of inquiry session?
Thanks for that question, Isis. I think that what I really love the listeners to hear and to know about are the six guiding principles of trauma-informed care developed by SAMHSA. And there is six, so I'd like to just briefly go through them, even though some, you know, some might just think looking at the principles makes it very clear what that principle is. I'm going to take us through it quickly here. Yeah. When we think about safety, this must occur throughout the entire organization. So it really has to be among staff, between staff and patients. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got to feel safe. Everybody has to have that feeling of being physiologically and psychologically safe. And the environment in which those interactions occur has to feel like it's comfortable for everyone. Mm-hmm. I can think often as an example that in one of our programs at the hospital, Bridges to Moms, they actually go in the community and the visits happen in the community where the patients are. And sometimes it might be at a coffee shop if a physical exam isn't required. And I think that's a great example of how to make one feel physiologically and psychologically safe. Another one is trustworthiness and transparency. And this really reflects on the policy and procedures of the organization, again, at the organizational level. And it assures that the decisions are conducted with transparency, with the main goal is to build and maintain trust within the organization with patients, their family members, and among staff. Mm-hmm. And I would also add within the community they serve. We have to have trust within that community that we provide care to and services to. Mm-hmm. And I think a good example of that is the community health needs assessments that many organizations need to do every few years that really gives us an opportunity to be transparent with those communities and to listen and to bring back their suggestions and ideas. Mm-hmm. And then peer support. And I, you know, SAMHSA had described peer support for patients. We've actually extended that to think about two perspectives on peer support, and that is for our patients, but also for colleagues and staff. So, you know, for ourselves, those of us that work together. For patients, it can serve as a key vehicle for the hope and healing. And it really does, as you said earlier in the podcast, it really calls out one's strengths and resilience by sharing their lived experiences in a space that's safe. Mm-hmm. Amongst the staff, we can think about peer support and the TI principles provide a framework that really promotes a healthy work environment, teamwork, respect, right? And that should be amongst all members of the members of the team in the health institution, including vertically and horizontally. Mm-hmm. And then we would think about the next principle, which is collaboration. I do want to say, let me go back, that all of these principles sort of intersect with each other, right? They don't just sit out there mutually exclusive of each other. It's really a blending and all the principles if we think about them all in tandem.
Yeah.
So collaboration and mutuality, here the foci is really on partnering in leveling the power differences amongst staff, including staff that work the front desk, housekeeping, engineering, IT, et cetera, to the professional staff and to the administrators. Mm-hmm. According to SAMHSA 2014, their concept of trauma and guidance for a trauma-informed care approach, safety and healing occur in the context of relationships. The organization recognizes really that everyone has a role to play in a trauma-informed care approach. In fact, two experts on this report, Ford and Wilson, stated that one does not have to be a therapist to be therapeutic. Mm. The next principle, empowerment, voice, and choice. Again, it's best recognized when it is intentionally built into and throughout the organization. Core to empowerment is the recognition of one's strong resilience of their communities and of the individuals within their families. And ways to foster this principle include, you know, shared decision-making, purposely developing a workforce that represents the community, and patients being actively engaged in the development of their care plan. Mm. Rather than being prescriptive, the goal here is to create a plan of care with patients, assuring access to services needed and engagement encounters that are meaningful to them. Mm. So it's not just about, as a provider, thinking what's best for my patients. It's with my patients, understanding what they feel is best for them. Mm. And so this is really a parallel process. And according to staff, they're empowered to do their work as best as they possibly can when they have a voice and when they have choice and when they feel that they are being heard.
Yeah.
And then lastly, I guess we have the last guiding principle, and that would be cultural, historical, and gender acknowledgement. And again, organizationally, there has to be an awareness both vertically and horizontally across the organization that's relative to unconscious bias, such as stigma, and how that relates to care that's provided using a racial justice equity lens. And that does mean explicitly talking about race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, religion, et cetera. Mm-hmm. There must be a commitment to proactively address policies and procedures. And for example, explicit bias will not be tolerated. We have to be really intentional in saying that we will not tolerate that in this institution. Mm-hmm. And education can really address the analysis of how structural racism advantages some people while disadvantaging others, and that there is an intersection between racism and outcomes and health. Mm-hmm. In fact, our team really thinks that racism is trauma, and when one's life experiences include individual, interpersonal, and historical trauma, the impact on one's health is notable and significant.
Yeah, definitely. And so if I'm hearing like what you're saying, I think one thing that you really touched upon within each of the principles that's kind of comprehensive, like kind of uniform across all of them, is that there really has to be this acknowledgement of these principles at the organizational level to really be able to successfully mm-hmm. implement them. So that is super important and kind of brings me to the next point of, you know, when we have folks, healthcare providers who are giving or who are inquiring about patients' health and their experiences, you know, how does that experience differ in a traditional model of healthcare delivery that is not as trauma-informed versus one that is trauma-informed?
I really appreciate that question, Isis. You know, and I know we'll have a wide range of listeners to this podcast today. Mm-hmm. I think this will resonate with some that have been practicing for a while, and it and for those that are new, it will probably even have more meaning. You know, our traditional model of care has really been one that looks at pathology and looks at what's wrong with people. Mm-hmm. In fact, we even have problem with some patients' charts, right? So we really look at their deficits. A traditional model often will assume that the provider knows more than the patient and that it's in the patient's best interest to listen to their provider. And it can be often very prescriptive. So, you know, a patient shares with you And the clinician goes right into the mode of, well, let me tell you what to do. And I think and pulls out a prescription pad and starts to offer, you know, anticipatory guidance, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And it's a model that we've, you know, many have worked in for a long time. And it was based on how we were trained. And now as we think about this trauma-informed care model and a model that I've been embracing now for many years, it moves away from deficit. It asks, what has happened to you? Mm-hmm. And how has what happened to you affected you? Mm-hmm. It also particularly is intentional in calling out one's strengths and resilience. Mm-hmm. So not only acknowledging those deficits, but if you have had some sort of traumatic events in your life and you're now sitting in my office, mm-hmm. well, tell me about, you know, how you've even gotten to be here. Mm-hmm. And often we find that that's something that not everyone would think about when working with their patients. Mm-hmm. And then again, the six principles, Isis, that I mentioned before, really incorporating those six principles and with a universal awareness that most people have been impacted by trauma in their lifetime.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. And I think when you think about the skills that one might need to be able to inquire about trauma, definitely, again, those six principles apply. But what else do you think is really needed to be able to inquire with patients when we're thinking about a trauma-informed lens?
Yeah, I think, you know, one main principle that the team that I work with, we feel pretty strongly that, you know, the main principle of trauma-informed care is really not to ask people to share details of the trauma in their life. So we really think it's important to state a universal awareness or a universal precautions approach, if you will. Mm-hmm. And that would mean just assume that everyone that you're encountering has probably had some sort of traumatic event in their life.
Yeah.
And so just universal awareness of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think something that I've kind of done incorrectly probably is that I've been using the term screening and inquiry kind of synonymously. So can you tell me what the differences are between screening and inquiry?
Yeah. And I think that people just use them interchangeably. So I'm not sure that you're using them wrong, but people will use them as they are one and the same word. Mm-hmm. However, we really think more about inquiry. But let's start with screening. So mm-hmm. screening is really a process by which we evaluate the presence of a particular problem or challenge or disease. And the purpose in the screening is to determine whether further testing or assessment is needed. And so I can use the example of cholesterol. We'll check your cholesterol. We'll screen mm-hmm. you for your cholesterol. And now your screening test comes back really high. Mm-hmm. There would be further testing to then figure out, well, what's your good cholesterol and what's your bad cholesterol? And, you know, what is the proportion of that to your overall cholesterol is needed? Mm-hmm. And whether that further assessment would then help with the treatment plan. Mm-hmm. We kind of like the idea of inquiry, and inquiry is really an act of asking for information. And we believe it is the act of asking and how one is asked and in what context and with what end goal. And then we have a lot of things we ask people to think about is, why are you asking the question? How will it change your plan of care? How will you share the information so the burden is not on the patient?
Yeah.
And what are the desires of the patient around sharing and documenting what they just told you?
Yeah.
So we think inquiry is really the right verb, and we think it's really dependent on your role, how much you're asking.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Definitely. I think something that would be really helpful to the listeners is if you could give kind of an example in the same way that you gave one for, you know, screening cholesterol, what would inquiry look like for a patient?
Sure. So we think that, you know, and we actually describe this quite a bit in our State of the Science paper on trauma inquiry. It was just published this year in Women's Health. And we have defined this as, you know, disclosure not being the goal, is ultimately what the messages we're trying to give. But we've also described this tiered approach to screening. Mm-hmm. And the first thing is always that safe environment, right? That guiding principle that we talked about earlier, just making sure, you know, do you want the door open or is there another space that would make you feel better? Is this room too small to you? Should we move to a larger room? Mm-hmm. We really want to minimize the need to retell the story. So one of the things I do now is I stop and pause and say, how much of this story do I need to hear?
Yeah.
Includes a lot of, you know, sort of education about the effects that this traumatic event can have on you as a person. I've heard people say, geez, I think I'm crazy. I have these unbelievable headaches. I can't go out in public. I get so anxious. And this is an opportunity to take time to stop with the patient and to do some education. You're not crazy. I can understand your anxiety related to, you know, based on what you told me that happened. Stomach aches can often be associated with sort of the experience you just went through. And so to really make that connection and balance, again, the trauma and the resilience. I'm so sorry to hear this is going on. And I think you did a great job. You showed up today. You came to our last appointment. Mm-hmm. I see you making lots of efforts with other things to always bring that into the discussion. And then really important, Isis, is that people are aware and cognizant how their own histories may come into the room in ways that may not be intentional. It may be completely unconscious. Mm-hmm. But how does that make one feel as a provider if they have their own trauma histories? How do you center yourself in that encounter with the patient? Mm-hmm. And how do you yourself process sort of all these stories you're hearing in a way that will keep you whole and keep you, you know, from feeling the effects of vicarious trauma yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So those, you know, and we have some questions that we think about as well that are a little bit different than the traditional questions.
Yeah. And I know that you know, that tiered approach, that first is that broad inquiry. And you started to touch a little bit upon them during your examples. But can you share some of more of what those broad inquiry questions would really look like or what they would even refer to in the context of inquiry?
Yeah, sure. You know, we really, when we think about the questions and all of us that have been doing this work, our frontline clinicians in clinical settings, we really believe that the locus of control for our encounters has to be with patients.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes it can be with the provider feeling like, I need all this information. I need to hear it all. I need to be able to bill. I need to be able to develop treatment plans. We actually feel that locus of control around what they share and how much they share should really rest with the patient.
Mm-hmm.
So the questions we have, and we're beginning on the inpatient setting to ask nurses to try these out and tell us what they think and give us some feedback. But the first question is, has anything happened in your life that you feel has impacted your health and your well-being?
Mm-hmm.
So it's very broad, right?
Sure.
I've actually heard some people say to me, oh, that's a very broad question.
Mm-hmm.
It's intended to be broad. And I've shared this with other forums where I've had discussions around this. I've had two people share with me that they were in a plane crash.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't ask about the plane crash specifically. What I asked about was, what impact did that have on your life?
Yeah.
Clearly they survived. They didn't have any physical injuries that I could see, but there had to be an impact.
Mm-hmm.
I had another young girl who was in a really bad car accident when she was young, and her three best friends died.
Mm-hmm.
And so this question is broad and is stated the way it is because people have had many different types of traumatic events. And we think that this type of questioning would help them in that discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And then we don't ask about the details, although there is a caveat there, Isis. And
mm-hmm.
if someone comes in acutely after a traumatic event, we do ask lots of questions about the event. And in that context, it makes sense because we need to decide what tests to do, what other kinds of services is this patient going to need, do I need to do more x-rays than I originally thought, et cetera. So in acute episodes of trauma, we really do need to sort of have the details of the event. But anything past an acute event, we feel these broad questions are more helpful.
There
is one other question I'll add. You know, so has anything happened and what's been the impact on you? The other one is that have you had any experience with the health, with healthcare, with receiving healthcare that you feel I should know about? And some people have had positive and negative experiences with healthcare. And it's helpful to know that because if they had, in particular, an OBGYN person or someone doing a GYN exam on them, and it was not trauma-informed using those principles, they may be reluctant to then have another exam. And so if they share that with me, I could then maybe, you know, move forward by saying, you know, what would be helpful? How can I make you safe during this particular visit and make you feel comfortable? What are some of the things that you think would be, would work?
Yeah, that's really powerful. I think that in the context of kind of what we've been chatting about this whole time, the differences between, you know, screening and inquiry. And I think this part has really like resonated with me because even as, you know, a graduate student within psychology, we talk a lot about screening and, you know, screening for trauma. It's like, what is the, that one event? Think about one event that has impacted you the most. And it's like, we're asking patients to not only, you know, resonate and think about this one trauma and ask them all these questions about it when, like you, we've mentioned previously that trauma is not this one experience or event, but it's kind of like this mix and mingling of all these different experiences that people have gone through. And so something that, you know, you have really brought up within me to think about is that these broad inquiry questions and just inquiry in general gives a lot of respect to the patients, and it really helps in reducing re-traumatization just because it's so much about the patient's choice about, you know, what they're wanting to really disclose with you. And I think that's really powerful for them. And also as a provider to be able to make sure that, you know, you are limiting that re-traumatization and you're actually helping them. So when, of course, I mean, everyone wants to be able to do this and everyone wants to be able to inquire in the most trauma-informed way. You know, we don't want to be hurting our patients. You know, that's kind of the first, you know, tenet of medicine, you know, do no harm. But what are some, you know, good tips or, you know, some pearls the listeners can take in regards to responding to someone who has shared their trauma with a provider?
I think that, I think one, you just, you want to thank them for being able to share and acknowledging, that that was probably not easy, but that you, you want to honor them and thank them for sharing what they did, share with you. And then I think it's really, you know, they may not have heard this, and while it might, you know, sound sort of trite, is, you know, you didn't deserve this. This wasn't your fault. I say that often in patients that have been victimized by sexual assault. This is not your fault. You did nothing to deserve this. And I also, I think it's real important, and I may not have said this a little bit earlier, I think it's real important to have sort of this stop rule with your patients. You know, either, you know, at any point, if you want me to stop asking questions, if at any point during the physical exam you want me to stop, I will stop. And again, that goes back to the principle of trust, right, and transparency. Real important, because a patient might come in saying, oh, haven't had a physical, I'm going to do it this time. And there you are, and you're doing a physical exam, right, which is they're disrobed, you're touching, you're palpating, and it may set off a trigger in them. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that and to be really attuned to sort of the body language of patients and just say, would you like me to stop? But even go further, like if you had that stop rule established earlier, right? And you just said that, they could have a signal, Yeah. You know, if I put my hand up or if I just put up my hand, like, can you stop? Mm-hmm. I think those are really, really important skills to have and to bring into the, you know, to bring into the encounter and into the visit with the patient.
Yeah. So is there anything else here that you want to discuss before we go into the closing?
Oh, thank you. I you know, the one thing that I know people are probably thinking about is, you know, documentation. And, mm-hmm. You know, we have had a discussion about having a podcast because we feel it's just, you know, that in and of itself is something worth a further discussion into. But documentation, given sort of the electronic health record being front and center now, something for us to all think about. But in the meantime, of sorting out exactly what that would look like, we do encourage people to work with their patients to decide how much or how little to put in the healthcare record in regards to their personal traumas.
Yeah, that's a really good note. So, you know, in closing, if you think about something that you would like the listeners to take away from today's episode in regards to trauma-informed care or inquiry or both of them, what would that be?
Oh boy, what would that be? I think that we would hope that the value of trauma-informed care, and specifically its applicability in the medical clinical encounter, will have a positive impact on patient engagement and potentially mitigate the health consequences caused by exposures to traumatic experiences, and that the impact on the providers serving patients with trauma histories would also be more meaningful to the provider as well.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Jenny. I feel like in many times that I have these conversations with a lot of folks, I realize that I think sometimes when you work within a specific field, you kind of think like, oh, I already know this. Coming from this background of like, oh, well, you know, I am very social justice oriented and I'm, you know, I do trauma-informed care work. You kind of think that you already know how it works. But every time I learn a lot. And so thank you so much. And I know that this has probably been really meaningful, like you said, to people who have been doing this already and people maybe who are just starting or people who have never even listened to the podcast before. So I just wanted to say thank you, Annie, for joining me today and really being able to have this conversation with me.
Thank you, Isis. I appreciate it much and look forward to talking with you again sometime soon.
If you would like to follow up with Annie or ask her any questions throughout the week or anytime, you are welcome to find her on Twitter at ALO Boston. Make sure to rate us and leave comments for things that you like or even some topics that you'd like to see us cover. But until then, we'll be counting down the minutes on TikTok.